When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Stop in and save big money on your next outdoor lumber project now at Menards. Menards has the largest selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber and decking, and it's easy to load in our outdoor lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Check out our weekly flyer for more great deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the No Bad Dogs podcast with me, Tom Davis, America's canine educator, the podcast where we love, live, and of course, work with dogs. Today, I have a friend and a guest on the show. His name is Pete Fisher. Pete Fisher is a liaison and also somebody who represents Dogtra, who makes e-collars, and it's a partnership that Dogtra and I have done for 2020 to work together to do the best we can to educate and to help people out with the remote collar process and education. And so we're going to talk to Pete about his involvement going back to the early 60s of the remote collar training and the history of the remote collar, and talk about SHOT Show that we're doing here in a couple weeks in Las Vegas. And so welcome, Pete, to the show.
Hello, it's Pete.
Hey, Pete, it's Tom. How you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
Good, man. Sorry about the confusion on the time. I so thought you were 2 hours behind me.
No. I'm just one. And that's yeah, you know, it's hard to figure out, Tom, because of all the work I do for Dogtra, you know, and they're 2 hours behind me.
Yeah.
So
right.
Right now it's 7:20 out there, and a lot of people don't realize that. You know, that I'm not sitting in an office out there and. In California, but anyway, it'll work.
So let's just roll right into it, Pete. And I want you to just tell everybody on the podcast who you are, what you do, how long you've been doing it, and we'll go from there.
Sure, I can do that, Tom. I kind of a jack of all trades, master of none, so to speak. My background is, and I'm older. I'm older than I probably sound or look. How's that? I don't know if that's good or not, but I'm high school educated, Tom. I live up here in Minnesota, Albany, Minnesota. I did some construction work right out of high school. And then I was fortunate, Tom, to work for a local dog trainer by the name of Lawrence Martins. And Lornie, as he, everybody called him, he was a retriever trainer and is actually in the Retriever Trainers Hall of Fame. And so I worked for Lornie as an assistant back many, many years ago, let's just say, and it was a good gig. And then I got hired after that to work as a vet tech. And that's back in the day, Tom, the local veterinary clinics hired individuals and trained you to be a vet tech. They didn't send you off to school. There was no such thing back then.
That's interesting. Yeah. So they'll actually do the vet tech courses in-house.
They just took me and trained me, hired me and trained me back then. But again, we're talking ancient history back in about 1979, this was, Tom. And so there was no such thing as going to school back then to be a vet tech. And so I worked there for a couple years. And then I was the early morning person at the vet clinic. So I started training some dogs before I even had a facility, Tom, just on the side. I'd go pick them up at people's houses, train them and drop them back off. And primarily, my background is retriever training, and I work for another local retriever training kennel by the name of Deltone Kennels, which is a very large operation in St. Cloud. And I started on my own, and about the early 80s, Tom, is what as best I can put a finger on it. And I got purchased some land, and our facility, Fisher's Kennels and Hunt Club, is still in existence. And I took it from training and handling five dogs in the facility. We purchased 360 acres and grew the facility And pretty soon I had a staff of people working for me. And when we were full, we actually kept dogs with us, Tom, for boarding and training. Mm. I could handle 50 dogs at that facility. And it was no longer just me. And so 10 years ago, I sold the business to one of my assistants. But I had been with another remote collar training company called Tritronics. And I was on something called mm-hmm. Team Tritronics way back in the day. And then Dogtra came around. And I got to know the owners of Dogtra and just kept doing some different things, working events for them, stuff, events like the SHOT Show, where you and I will be working in the very near future.
Two weeks, in a couple days. Yeah.
Yeah. And so even back when I had the business, Tom, I was kind of like you. I was doing some part-time gig work, gigs for other companies. And so as an example, Tom, this will be my... I can't remember, Tom, my 18th or 19th SHOT Show working for Dogtra.
Wow.
So, but when I sold the business 10 years ago, I had an agreement that I could go to work for Dogtra, and that's what I did. And so I like to work. This is kind of right in my wheelhouse, what I do for Dogtra now. And I work as a private contractor for them, Tom. I'm not an actual employee. But my bosses are the owners of Dogtra. That's who I deal with on a regular basis. And Alex and James, so those are the owners of Dogtra. And so that's what I do. I got introduced at our rep group here about a year or so ago, and they said Pete's the Swiss Army knife for Dogtra, so I can do a little bit of everything for the company. How's that? So
that's perfect. I like
hopefully that. Explains what I do. But really my background, Tom, is training dogs for other people, primarily retrievers. But in the end, I you know, my career at the business, I trained some of everything, but primarily I was a retriever trainer.
Mm, cool. Mm-hmm. I want to rewind a little bit and talk about when you were talking about when you used to work at the kennel, because a lot of the people who I have found, and the other thing cool about this podcast, Pete, is I was actually looking last night on some of the stats of where people are coming from, and there's thousands of people that listen to every single episode, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And they're from all over the world, Australia, India, China, everywhere. I mean, I was looking at some of it's really amazing. And I know a lot of people, including myself, like to know how people got started a little bit more in depth, because I think that they can relate to that. So when you were handling dogs for the vet clinic, and after you were trained to become a vet tech at the time, what were you doing? Were you just kind of doing the morning let outs, doing the cleaning up poop, feeding them and things like that? What was your daily operation back in the?
Great question, Tom. When I worked for the veterinary clinic in St. Cloud, Minnesota, I worked there about 2.5 years. And so my duties there were, I was the early morning guy, person that, so I let dogs out, exercise them, and cats, took care of them.
Mm-hmm.
But primarily it was dogs. And so I was the cleanup guy. I was assisted in surgery. I helped with all the x-rays. I did the blood workup. I did some of everything at that clinic. The only thing I never really did was any of the clerical work, you know, the receptionist work. I would answer phones when we got busy. I would help with the vaccination of dogs, the drawing of the blood, running the blood. We had in-house equipment to do that. We did all of our x-rays in-house. And so I did all that. So yeah, I did some of everything. And right in the surgery room, I was the main assistant when Glenn was the owner of the clinic, the veterinarian. And so I assisted Glenn every morning when he got in at 9 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
We started doing all the regular surgeries. I was his night guy. I was single back then, Tom. So if there was an emergency surgery, my phone rang. This was back before cell phones, by the way, too. And he'd call and say, Peter, I need you in here to run the gas machine. We've got a dog that was hit by a car.
Wow.
Got to go into surgery. So I did some of everything for them. It was really a great experience, Tom.
Yeah.
Little did I know how much that would pay off for me years later as I started on my own. And as you know, with dealing with dogs, there's always something that can potentially go wrong. I mean, you have enough dogs in your life. My old veterinarian buddy, David Tomshi over here, that I deal with now, says, you know, you're going to run into one of everything if you have enough dogs and you stay in this business long enough.
Exactly. And that's something I tell as many people as I can, especially when I used to do dog walking. When I started off, is I tell people a time frame I would be there, and I say, you know, I'm going to give you a 2-hour time frame of me coming to your house and letting your dog out, because animals are not predictable, and I have no idea what's going to happen.
And it's not a piece of equipment.
No, and it's not technology, and you can't reprogram it really quick and shove batteries back in it and reset it and make it work.
You got to
clean up diarrhea and chase a dog that slipped the collar, and there's so much that goes into it. Yeah, that sounds like a really good experience for you to get into first starting off or in your preliminary stages of working with dogs to do everything from doing surgeries with dogs, taking blood, learning about vaccinations. You probably learned a little bit of behavior while you're there.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
That's really interesting. Yep. And so go ahead.
It was just a good foundation to what I call my career of, you know, building the business, the dog training business. That's really what I ended up being known as, the dog guy. Most of my clients came out of the Minneapolis, St. Paul area.
That's it, man. And that's what I try to tell everybody in the dog industry. I get a lot of emails and messages of how they want to get into the industry. And basically what you just said, you basically have to go and shovel crap and wake up early and be tired and be stressed and strung right out on all the problems of other people. And that's a really good way to get your feet wet, because in the dog world, as you know, it's really tough to say, you know, here's the, I recently saw a quote that was like, the proof is in the pudding, not in the print. Meaning there's so much that you have to learn outside of reading behavioral books or any type of book, really. And that's a really good way to do it, is just get in and get boots on the ground. And I started off that way as well, just helping daycares and helping with the daycares and switching them out and doing dog cleanups and all that stuff, just to get my feet wet in not only with the dogs, but the customer service of how to handle certain situations. And I think that that's really important in any canine career, is to start off at that level.
Exactly, Tom. And something that gets overlooked in any business, really. And I don't know if you're going to agree with this or not. I think you're going to. Many times training the dog is the easiest part of the job when you do what we do.
Yeah.
You dealing with the people is the next part of it. Not always, you say to people, they would stay, their dogs would come and stay with us for, most of them initially would come for 6 weeks minimum.
Wow.
Many of them stayed for months and months, but you know, these were dogs that were being trained as gun dogs.
Right.
We were obedience training, electric collar conditioning is what we call it. Association of Gun and Birds. We were doing handling patterns. Some of them were ribbon runners, but primarily I trained dogs for people that wanted a duck or pheasant retrieved and not a ribbon. But I did do a bunch of the competitions, or what we call nowadays hunt tests. I did a lot of that with my own dogs. But you know, part of it is training the dog, but also I would tell people, look, I can train your dog, you got to come up here and work with them, but at the end of the day, I got to stay here. I can't go home with your dog. So a big part of that is training the dog and trying to guide the people and show them that this is just, I got you a really good start, but I can't be there all the time. So part of it, my first part of the job was train the dog. The second part was train the owner. So that's really a really big part of it. And so I'm a people person also. I worked for a couple different people over the years that were really good at what they did, but they weren't very good with people. I always called it, they didn't have very good bedside manner.
Correct.
And that's a big part of it to be successful, Tom. I still operate that way in my work with Dogtra. When we have problems and the customer service people can't handle somebody and they turn them over to me, one of the first things I say to them is, you know, I'm your last person to deal with here. Let's see if we can figure this out. Be nice to me. I'm going to be nice to you. If they start dropping F-bombs on me, I'll just say to them, you know what, we need to part company here. But I think that's really important in any business you get into, besides putting in the hours. I mean, you know what it's like, Tom. Doing what you do, I mean, you don't keep track of the hours because it's scary if you start logging in your hours, but it's your passion. And so that's a big part of it as well. You know, not only being able to train a dog, work with people, but also accept the fact that you really don't have much of a personal life anymore once you start on your own.
100%. Yeah, and I learned that pretty quick. My 20s were gone. I mean, absolutely gone. It was really tough. Not only working with dogs, but just starting a business at a young age in general.
Yep.
Where all of your friends are in their prime in college, and in their prime in their partying and going out and going to bars and that whole nine. And I was waking up at 5 a.m. crashing kibble and bowls. I just have a different, you know, and for me it was about, like you said, like the passion. And I think you're the one who told me this a while back, Pete. We're not in the dog business; we're in the people business.
Yeah,
and
that is true.
Yeah, and and that's something that a lot of people who are working with dogs professionally, or even people who have dogs that are wanting to work with other people. I tell people all the time, you know, in what I do. Is there's a, like you just mentioned, Pete, I'm glad you mentioned it. There's a significant difference with somebody who is really good with, there's a lot of people that are really good with animals, a lot, but you find very few that can hybrid and weld together somebody who can have information to relate from the dog. You have to be a median kind of person, where you're relating the information from the dog to the person in a very empathetic, digestible way, which that's where the rubber meets the road. And I see that a lot and I see it even in my personal career where people become so frustrated that they may not be gaining clientele, or they may be losing clientele, or nobody knows they're there because it's kind of contradicting their instincts. Cause they're like, man, I can really get a dog. And this goes for horse trainers and bull riders or however, anybody in the animal kingdom. You could be really, 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 really good at what you do.
Yep.
But if you can't tell people how to do it,
yep.
I mean, you're not selling art. People aren't buying your paintings to say, hey, good job, I want to buy it and be done with you. You have to be able to educate people, and I think that's a really important topic.
It really is, Tom. And again, not only it's not only what you say, but how you say it. Okay,
right.
And I can there are a number of trainers that I've dealt with, professional and amateur, that they really know their stuff, but they're very negative people. They're chronic complainers. All they do is bitch, and they bring that attitude with them wherever they go. And sometimes I sit back and I look at them and I think, man, how did you ever get to where you're at with that kind of attitude? So you and I are a lot alike. I have a very positive attitude. I'm very secure in what I do also. Okay. but I think part of it is as I'm dealing with a person and a dog, I want to come off that. Not only do I want to be able to express that I know what the hell I'm doing, but also I want to be good about it. I don't want to have that negative attitude and that bitchy attitude with everything, because I that's just, life is too short, and I think people don't learn very good in those situations.
No.
So I think a good dose of reality and being positive when you're dealing with people, being kind of lighthearted, being able to joke around also. Don't take yourself so damn serious. I run into some people like, wow, you're a great dog trainer, but listen, you know, I could care less.
Yeah.
You know what? It's about having a positive energy. And not only to the dog, but also to the individual you're working with. So I think those are really some little pieces that individuals have a tendency to overlook.
Mm.
Whether you're a dog trainer, Tom, or anything you do in life, that's
100%.
I see that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think too, dog owners, when they come in for training, I always am so empathetic towards the situation to say, you know, it's kind of like the alcohol programs where you come in, you say, hey, I'm an alcoholic, and everyone says, hi, me too. It's kind of the same thing when people come in with dogs. They have to admit that they've lost control and they need help. Sometimes that's, as you probably know, sometimes that's really easy for people. They say this is a nightmare, help. And then other times it's not. I find people are like, I'm the type of person, you know, I've had Fortune 500 CEOs that I've worked with they don't like telling people that they can't fix something.
Right.
And that doesn't have anything to do with male or female. It's just, you know, how that goes. And so I'm always the type of person that steps back and say, hey, I don't know everything, but listen, I've been doing this long enough and I feel confident that I can help you. Let's try to figure this out together.
Yep.
And that even though I may be able to help them in a matter of minutes, I never try to wear that on my sleeve because it makes it doesn't make them feel good. You want to be empowering and teaching people how to work with their dogs because you want it to be fun.
Yeah, and the other thing, when you've done it as long as you've done it now, and you're a lot younger than me, Tom, people would call up, or even to this day when I'm troubleshooting dog problems for customers at Dogtra, they'll get me on the phone and they'll say, well, geez, you know, the dog is doing this and this and this. And I say, you know what, it sounds like you got a pretty normal dog. There's nothing you've told me in the last 10 minutes that I'm sitting here with my mouth hanging open saying, wow, this person really has problems. You know, when you're in it long enough, you've heard just about every story.
Yeah.
And then the flip side also, Tom, is you find people that say, you know, my dog is really good. You know, when you see my dog, you're going to be so impressed. But then I've got one problem, you know, if he's off the rope or leash, he runs away.
Yeah.
And I'll say, well, that sounds like kind of a big problem.
That's a big problem.
Yeah.
That's the only problem.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I try and take that lighthearted approach to it. I like to be able to say to somebody, you know, what I just said earlier, hey, what you've told me up at till this point, I've heard this story before. It's nothing that we can't work on, that we can't make an improvement. Are we going to fix it 100%? Well, do we ever really fix any behavior issue 100%? A lot of it, Tom, has to do with, are the owners willing to implement the training when they get the dog back home?
Right.
That's a big key. That's a big part of it.
Yeah. And I love seeing those. I got a video last night from one of my clients in Colorado of them playing a video of me. And then the dog sitting there running to the room, tilting his head like, hey, I know that person. They want to straighten me out. And I think that creates a lifetime relationship with those dogs that you work with because you have that relationship. And that's true. There's so many times where people would come in tears, just distraught because their puppy is biting things. And you're like, and that's the part about, like you said, P, it's a great way to put it, like your bedside manner. You want to laugh, but at the same time, they're serious and they don't do this professionally. And they weren't born to do this. They're not in it. So it's a really good point. I want to talk about, so I just have a question. When you said Tritronic, so I used to, one of my best friends used to run beagles at a beagle and hair club. And was Tritronic a part of the Garmin series?
I love history with dog training and specifically retriever training and remote training collars. And I'm kind of the historian for Dogtra, just so you know, because I've been with the company so long. But Tritronic was one of the first remote training collars that ever came on the market. And they were eventually purchased by the Garmin company, based out of Olathe, Kansas. And so that's what almost everybody that trained professionally back in the days when I started, excuse me, Tom. You were using Tritronic. There were only a couple manufacturers of remote training collars on the market back then. I think two other ones. There was Inatec and possibly a company by the name of Dog Radartron, which eventually turned into DT Systems, which both those companies are around yet. Inatec got bought out by a company called Radio Systems, which is based out of Tennessee. So that's the Sport Dog Pet Safe brand. And Tritronic got bought by Garmin.
That's what I thought. Because when you said Tritronic, it brought me a lot of nostalgic back. Because I remember my buddies, and that was even before I professionally worked with dogs. I'd be up at a beagle and hair club, watching those beagles tally-hoeing through the grass, and that was always really impressive to watch those beagles work. So
exactly.
So moving forward from the blast from the past, there, Pete. Let's talk a little bit about your experience with when, and I'm glad that you said that you're kind of the historian with Dogtra, because that's what I want to know personally is in your experience going back to the beginning of the remote collar introduction to the industry, if you will, what were people using remote collars for back when you saw it starting to develop? What was it being used for and why was it being developed?
Well, the most people back in the day were using it for hunting dog training. I think early on, most of the remote training collars were probably developed by hound people that were hunting big cats out in Arizona, you know, big ranging dogs. Mm-hmm. And if you saw the equipment that they were using. I mean, it looked like a CBers convention. They had those long antennas that, yeah, you know, came out, you know, expandable antennas. So I think I'm pretty sure that the roots of electric dog training started with the hunting dog market, and really just the hunting dog market is still the biggest. Most of our product gets sold into the hunting dog market to this day yet. Now, I can't speak for our competitors, but I know Dogtra is a big part of our, a big sector for us is still the hunting dog market, and specifically the retriever market. Because if you historically in the last 10, 15 years, if you look with the amount of dogs registered with the American Kennel Club, the Labrador Retriever has been number one with the most dogs registered. If you go out hunting up in the Midwest here, you're most apt to run into a Labrador Retriever out in the field, waterfall hunting or upland hunting. That's still, you know, a lot of those dogs are being bred and used out in the field. Consequently, a lot of, remote training collars are getting sold to that market. The biggest market that's out there is probably the pet dog world, because there's more pets out there than there is any other, but that's taken us, you know, they have not become mainstream in the pet training industry, as sector yet, but we're getting there, as you're well aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that that's still, like you said, that's still a thing, that the remotes are being used for primarily hunting. And do you think that was more for calling? I mean, if you got to think about it, if you're working with a big cat, I mean, that's the significant difference between life and death of certain scenarios. If you have to recall your dog off a certain scenario, or what have you, I don't have a lot of experience with that type of hunting or training, but what were they primarily being used for? Recall or just tracking? Because I know some of the models have a great tracking mechanism to them as well. So,
well, yeah, no, a lot of the there's product out there now that has a GPS system in it, so you can track the dog. We make one that's called Pathfinder. Most of the companies make a unit like that has GPS and the e-collar integrated into one. Ours actually runs through your smartphone. But back in the day, these were when they developed this product. It was just plain and simple for breaking dogs, big running dogs, hound dogs, cat dogs, coon dogs, from breaking them from running deer. So they were probably just one level of stimulation, which was high, and they would just implement a high level of stimulation when they knew the dog was running a deer and they were out coon hunting, or they were running cats and the dog was running something it shouldn't have been. And so they would just break them of running this unwanted game by just giving them a high level of stimulation and knocking the hell out of them. And the dog, which is not, as you're well aware, the best way to use a remote training collar. And consequently, they have developed product now that we can adjust the stimulation levels at our fingertip. Back then, they were one level of stimulation, and it was very powerful.
Yeah, it was ouch.
Yeah, we've come a long way, to say the least. And now everybody makes remote training collars that has the adjustability of the stimulation right at your handheld. You know, that's probably been the biggest advancement in remote training collars in the last 20 years. And we've got smaller transmitters now. We don't have these great big long antennas, so they've become much more compact and much more. I mean, back in the day, 40 years ago, when they developed these, the transmitter was about half the size of a shoebox. You know, you got to think about how our cell phones have advanced as well.
Oh, man.
So all of our technology has advanced. And so now we have product out there that's you can use a very light level of stimulation. You can use the vibrations. You've got tones, and you've got a transmitter that'll fit in your pocket while you're having your dog out on an afternoon morning walk in suburbia. And it's not like you're carrying around a small portable TV.
Right, it doesn't surprise me at all that technology has advanced, and that's one thing I try to. I don't necessarily care for to argue with people about the remote collars, because over the next 10 years, it's just going to be like people are going to go, "Holy crap! I was so silly to think that's what that they're equating the remote collar from back." What year do you think that was, Pete, when they were using the remote collars for that type, like, range?
Oh, I think some of the earliest remote training collars by Tritronics were developed back in the, I'm going to say the 60s, late 60s, Tom, for sure the 70s. Some of the early ones, the ones that were shaped like almost as the transmitter was about the size of a shoebox. Those may have been in the early 60s. But again, we've come so far.
So far.
Yeah, I mean, the transmitters nowadays, some of our Dogtra transmitters, the ones that you use, you know, you can fit them in your pocket. You barely know they're there.
And
we still got good range and stimulation out of them. So, yeah, we've come a long ways, to say the least.
Yeah, and it's interesting for me, Pete, just as a consumer in life on the planet that we live in, to see, I mean, even the first iPhone was introduced in 2007. And on the grand scheme of things, 2007 really wasn't that long ago. But look how far we've come.
Agree.
From just that. I mean, being able to do some of the things that we can do on our phone has changed the world.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest industries in the world is also the dog world. It's something that everyone is it's constantly growing, as you know. And I think it's magnificent. I think people need to take a step back and say, wait a minute, because they're relating the 60s and 70s implementation of a tool and relating to 2020, 2019.
Right.
And that's what they're, and so there's a lot of ignorance that comes with some of the stuff. And I know that we could talk probably all day on that, which I don't want to get into too much, but I like hearing your info, because I don't really know for sure, because I wasn't alive.
Right.
To know when was this stuff implemented. And it's nice to know that even in the 60s and for sure the early 70s, the e-collar has progressed probably year by year by year until now. And the things that, I mean, to be able to track your dog from your iPhone sitting on the couch if it's running around outside, and be able to just tap them from a distance is huge. And I also think that even back in the 60s and 70s when the levels were ouch, I also think that there's a part of the conversation that needs to come out, that when we're dealing with a corrective level on a remote collar on any level, I think that there's a lot of misrepresentation of people who have never even seen a working dog work. If you've seen a retriever, or I've seen beagles work really hard, and I've seen hounds work really hard. When you correct them on something like that, they kind of just shake a little bit and then go right back to either doing the right thing or the wrong thing. It's not something that they sit back and they think about and they take to heart, and they're upset and they're mad and they're trying to figure out what they did wrong. When a dog is working, I've seen dogs, I'm sure you have too, Pete, in your field, I've seen dogs get sticks wedged right in their jugular and their eyes poked out, and their nose ripped off by certain animals, and they just keep going. They don't care.
Yeah.
And so back in the day, and even still to today, having the ability to reach out and touch your dog from a distance is, when it's done, it's only to help that dog understand that they're doing something that could potentially be deadly to them. And if you ask yourself alternatively, okay, what else are you going to do? Well, I'm just going to yell until they come back. Well, there's a really good chance that's not going to break a working dog from that job. And I also think within the same breath, there's a working dog in almost every dog. The owners don't know it yet.
Yeah. Well, they're animals, and every one of them has some, a certain amount of what we call prey drive.
Right.
So we can go down and get a dog out of the pound, out of the rescue, out of the shelter. It could be a mixed breed. I don't care what breed it is. And that dog, most of them are going to want to chase after something. That's just something that dogs like to do. They like to chase after balls or sticks or other dogs or other critters or cars, and some more than others. So all of them have a certain amount of what I call prey drive in them, because they're animals.
Right.
And so to try and take that and control it is what we want to do, to make that dog suitable for a pet, so that when we take him outside, he or she doesn't run away, doesn't run on the road and get run over. So all we're trying to do at that point, Tom, in my opinion, is modify that dog's behavior so it pleases us, so that we can have it. And a dog that runs away and runs out in front of traffic, and I mean, that's not a dog that, I don't think anybody's pleased by that. if I have a working dog and I'm a retriever guy, I want a dog that'll go pick up my ducks. I want him to handle, like you were up at Otterness, as you probably saw, handling gun dogs, Tom.
Yeah.
That'll go left, right, and back, and they're like a guided missile to go find your duck and bring it back. That's a conservation tool. So I don't leave my birds laying in the field. So if I drop one out in the water, I've got a dog that'll do a blind retrieve and go and pick that up and bring it back. So they all have a purpose, whether it's a working dog or whether it's a – I spent some time with a guy by the name of Mike Ritland, who's a very well-known canine guy down in Texas. He's a great guy. And Mike's turned into a friend of mine, and we chat all the time. And to go down there and see those dogs work firsthand, it was amazing. I've been around the retriever sector all my life. I've been around pointing dogs, and nothing is more enjoyable than to see a working dog that's under control and does its job. Consequently, there's a hell of a lot of people out there, Tom, that don't want a working dog. They just have a pet. They want it to be controlled. And that's a lot of fun to be able to control that dog and have him so he minds the owner.
Yeah.
So everything's relevant. Depends what you want out of the dog.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I think just the show notes of that conversation is just really highlighting the fact of the technology advancements. And I think in some of the, and maybe you can give me a little bit of insight on this. As you know, I do a lot of remote collar training. I think everything that I do, I try to be creative with, because I think there's a lot of room in the industry to become creative because it is kind of new. And making the tools accessible to that creativity too, to try some new things with being humane, of course. And I always get the, well, it's illegal here. And I feel when people are saying that, they're proud of it. And I feel sorry for them because they don't know why, what they're missing out on. So do you have any, being in the industry as long as you have, do you have any feedback for me? As far as the making things illegal, it's a lot of political stuff going into it. And there's a lot of ignorance, and there's a lot of scaling back to the early 60s and 70s of dog training and trying to apply the same mythology. What is your thoughts as being somebody within the industry on the business end about certain countries banning remote collar training to control your dog off leash?
Well, the one thing I would say, I think we will see that in our day and age in the United States. We've seen it in different parts already, where they on local areas, they're trying to ban them. And much of it is because people are ignorant. They've never been around a remote training collar. They think it's a shock collar. They don't understand anything about it. They think it's cruel. They think it's the same as taking a fork and sticking it in the outlet of your house, you know, and it doesn't operate the same way. It's static electricity, runs on a very low amperage. It's basically, most training collars work very similar. If you've ever gone to physical therapy, it's similar to a TENS machine, a muscle stimulator. They don't have enough energy to burn, to cook tissue. A lot of misconceptions out there about that. But, you know, the internet nowadays is also a hell of a powerful tool. And can be good for us, but it can also be our worst enemy.
Yeah.
There's been we've seen it on local levels where they have tried, municipalities have tried to ban remote training collars. We had some of it written into our own laws up here in good old Stearns County, where I'm in Minnesota, and they sent the ordinances over to me and wanted me to look at them because I knew some people at the county. And I called him up and I said, I'm looking through this and you're talking about that you want to ban remote training collars at professional training facilities. I said, are you aware that your county, your sheriff's department dogs are all on a remote training collar? Your local St. Cloud Police Department dogs are all on remote training collars. And I know this because I sold them the collars and helped train them. So now what you're telling us is that it's okay for the local enforcement to have these, but the private citizen can't. That's a slippery slope, is what I told them. We're going to see more and more of that, Tom, and that got taken out of their ordinances once they realized what the hell. But they had gone to somebody that was a anti-e-collar person to help them write their ordinances. It got taken out, and we're all fine now. But that's some of the stuff we're dealing with. A lot of people don't know that. And I'll introduce you to some of these people at the SHOT Show, Tom, in a couple of weeks.
Awesome.
We actually have a manufacturers association group. So all the major manufacturers have an association that we abide by and we meet. I just had my Monday call in. We call once a month. And so it's all the competitors, the major competitors in the remote training caller field. And we'll have a meeting at the SHOT Show, separate, one on the Wednesday morning of SHOT Shows. We try and do that once a year.
Wow,
and
that's
really
cool.
The Manufacturers Association was created about 5 years ago. Being that we felt like we're going to see this movement mm-hmm. in the United States to make remote training callers illegal by different sectors of people. So it's out there. We're dealing with it. We're going to have to deal with it in the future. It's happened in Canada somewhat.
Do you think it's just a lack of education that these politics are just banning these things through a lens of ignorance, of meaning there's certain pet owners going, hey, politicians, these people are like you said, sticking forks and outlets on these dogs and frying yeah. them, which is literally impossible to do. And of course, I'm sure there's people out there that are using these things incorrectly and using them as complete aversive and punishment tools. But
yep.
do you think that that's where things are going wrong is the politicians aren't being educated on what these tools are and the capabilities they have and the technology advancements that they've made?
You know, I think that is a possibility, and I think it does happen. I think the other thing is there's different sectors of mostly in the pet dog industry that are anti-electric. We call them behind their back. We call them Amish. They don't want to use the remote training callers. They don't see the value in them. They think they're harmful, and that's their perspective.
Right.
That's their I'm okay with that, but
right.
then when they start trying to change legislation, implement legislation so that it's illegal to use them, I have a real hard time with that. And most of these people have never been out and experienced what
right.
a remote training caller can do for a dog. They just think they're bad because they have that connotation. You know, they are a shock caller, and a shock has got to hurt, and a shock is not good. And so those are the things that we're dealing with from that sector of people that dislike them, that say, hey, they're evil. And again, they don't know a lot about it, but they also have a voice, and they can sure go to the politicians and try and implement different rules and regulations. But then from a trainer's perspective and manufacturers that promote and use these products and know the value of them, then it's also our duty to go out and share our side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the politician that gets to decide what's appropriate and what isn't. So that's just, you know, it's that way with anything in our country. And it's, as you're well aware of, and it's just a tool.
Right.
It's a tool that we use to train a dog. And there's individuals, there's places where the remote training caller has been banned, and they'll use a club and a chain on a dog to whip the hell out of them, to beat them senseless. But they think an electric training caller is evil. And some of that is overseas in places where they've banned mm-hmm. them. So it's the tool. It's the tool and it's how it's used. So that's something that the average person needs to understand as they go start working with their dog, that this is just a tool that we use to modify a dog's behavior, and so that the dog is more controllable and more of a joy to have around. It's like any tool. There's a good way to use it and a bad way to use it.
Right. Yeah, I agree 100%. It's sad to see some of the path some of these things go down. And like I recently started to say, is any tool that we use, whether it's a slip collar, dominant dog collar, prong collar, mm-hmm. hell, even a harness.
Yep.
All it does is it reinforces behavior. So do we absolutely mm-hmm. need them to train? No, we don't. But we also don't need airplanes to go to California and back. And we also don't mm-hmm. need power tools to build a house. But man, I
yep.
tell you what, flying to California and coming back within 24 hours in the same day and building a house
yep.
with a power drill is so
yep.
much more efficient. And we're scratching our head like, man, what did we do before this? And I feel like that's the way some of the tools are. And we're not banning cars because there's idiot people out there drinking and driving and getting
yep.
into accidents. I mean, yep. If you take cars away, it's somebody else is going to find a different, you know, way to do yeah. things. So it's tough.
Well, it's a powerful tool. It's right at your fingertips. It doesn't require a lot of effort on the trainer's part. There's still a lot of finesse that needs to be implemented with the use of a training collar, in my opinion. I've seen people out there that are not very good with it. I've seen people that are just average. I've seen people that are really good with it and be able to read the dog, when to push the button, when not to push the button, what level of stimulation.
Yeah.
The ones that have tried the training collar and said, hey, I tried this. I only use it on dogs that I can't when I really need it. That's not a person that really has ever learned a program and how right. to implement the training collar. Every dog I ever trained at my business, I trained with a remote training collar. And, you know, once you see the value of it, you learn a program, you learn how to use it, get some finesse. You see the real value of it. The ones people that have tried it and didn't like it and said, it's just a shock collar. I don't need that. You know, that's the kind of person I would say it's a shitty carpenter that criticizes his tools. So
yeah,
there's somebody standing there that's got to work the drill, work the saw. And the same way with the training collar.
Yeah, 100%. No doubt. I'm with you on that. And as somebody like I try to learn something every day. I don't pretend like I know everything about anything. I try to learn as a student every day. As an outside perspective as a dog owner, because that's what I am first. It just kind of boggles my mind that it's even going down that path, and it's unfortunate for the dog owners and the future trainers as well.
Well, you know, if we could take individuals that are anti e-collar and send them out for a couple days of firsthand experience with someone like yourself or a good retriever trainer that puts dogs out into places 200-300 yards away, left, right, back. I mean, you've seen it now firsthand.
Oh, yeah.
And that isn't done, Tom, by running out in the field and reprimanding a dog. As you're well aware of, you know, when you start reinforcing commands at a distance, timing is everything.
Got
a dog out 200 yards away and you want him to go left and he goes right. That's where the remote training collar comes in. You remind him, hey, this was left and this was right.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really accomplish that by the time I throw on my tennis shoes and run out there. The moment is lost. And so for people that are have not seen the value of a remote training collar in the pet industry, in the working dog field, if they went and spent a day with somebody and really saw how this thing has worked and the benefit of it, I think we'd open up a lot of eyes, Tom.
Oh man, it's 100%, 100%. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you really quick that just so everyone else knows, and you know, Pete, I actually started getting into the remote collar training because my St. Bernard, who's now 10, decided to play chicken with a train. And that's the moment that I, you know, a lot of serendipity happened in my in my early career to push me to where I'm at today, which is why I am, you know, I'm here. There's a lot of things that kind of fell into place, and he decided to go on the train tracks, and he decided to run away from a train, and he was on the tracks. The train was coming. I had two options. I either jump and try to get my 150-pound dog to roll off the train tracks within seconds of the train pummeling both of us, or I get ran over by the train, or I watch my dog get ran over by a train. And so after I saved him and the conductor stopped and they came out with clipboards and they were so surprised that I was still alive because they said I was seconds away from being hit by the cow pusher in the front.
Wow.
That was, it was traumatic. Even to this day, it's hard to think about. But at that moment, I said, I never ever want that to happen again, ever.
Yep.
And so then I started looking into local trainers, and then that's how I stumbled across Dogtra, because I originally started working with an English lady, Janine Lazarus, and she was a head trainer at the Monks and New Skeet over in Cambridge here in New York. Mm-hmm. It's about an hour and a half for me, and then I started getting into remote collar training, and she said, and I thought the same thing. I said, well, yeah, heck, I'll correct my dog if he doesn't listen. She's like, yeah, but it's so much more than that. There's so much versatility to that. And that's how I started to learn, was through that phase. And that's how I was originally introduced to Dogtra, as there's a train going by my house right now.
I could hear it, yeah.
It's like, I'm telling you, man, the serendipity.
Oh, you're not on the tracks.
No, we're good. But anyway, so, and that's what led me to Dogtra. And I think I called you, I don't know what, Pete, like 6 years ago, 5 years ago, five, 6 years ago. And I said, hey.
Yeah, I'm going to say it was probably about that. about five, maybe.
Yeah. Yep. I said, hey, man, I love, you know, this new product I was introduced to. I want to learn more about it. I want to use it. I want to train with it. And that's where I first was introduced to you, Pete, and Dogtra in general. And so that's kind of the story. And yep. I'm sticking to it. So moving forward from that, I want to talk a little bit more about SHOT Show. So I have never been to SHOT Show, and I actually didn't know about it until this year. And recently, Dogtra and I have partnered up to work together in 2020 to do the best we can to help people out with the remote collar and introducing Dogtra to people. And so
yeah, we're going to be doing a bunch of videos, right, Tom?
Yeah. We have some videos on display, and we're doing some Q&As at SHOT Show. Yep. And so for everyone who doesn't know SHOT Show, it's in Las Vegas in 2 weeks. So January 21st to the 24th. And I'm going to be there, and Pete, you're going to be there, right?
Correct.
And how many, do you know off the top of your head, how many exhibitors and vendors there are at something like this? I know there's like, 60,000 people that come or something like that?
Yeah, it's about 63,000 or something go through the turnstiles. It's the largest outdoor show in the world. I think, Tom, it's one of the top 10
conventions
in the world also. So it's really well attended. SHOT Show stands for Shooting Hunting Outdoor Trade Show. So it's put on by the Shooting Sports Foundation is who puts this on. And so in its day, it was really more of a back 20 years ago, Tom, it was more of a hooks and bullets crowd, hunting and fishing. Mm. Now we see some of everything. It's really expanded. You're going to see a lot of tactical companies there. It's not something, just so the listeners are aware of, it's not something you can just walk up and say, give me a ticket. I want in. You have to be somehow in the outdoor field, and you've got to prove that. You've got to have a business license. You've got to have, I don't think they even take a business card. You've got to be, it's a quote buyer show, so to speak. So
now is that to attend or is that to exhibit?
To attend, just to walk in, and it's spendy. I don't know what a 4-day pass costs you, but I'll bet it's, $100, $75, $150, something like that.
Mm.
So you can't just walk up and walk in. You would have had to have get your pass early on, and you got to have some credentials that you're in the outdoor industry in order to attend this thing. So I don't know how many thousands of booths they have there. It's on a couple floors. I think it's now this year. It's going to be on an additional site as well. This thing has grown to just mammoth in size. It's unbelievable how big this is. But it's anything outdoor related. But we've also started seeing a lot of tactical companies come in and are exhibiting. You're going to find all the major gun manufacturers are there. Pretty much all of the remote training collar companies will be there on a smaller scale. Some of the booths that these gun companies put up are amazing, Tom. They're the size of your house.
Wow.
So, very much outdoor related, everything that's there.
Yeah, that sounds, I'm excited. When I got invited to come and hang out with you guys for the week, I was like, yeah, sure. What is it?
Yeah.
And now I started, doing some research on it. And, I know some other companies that are going to be there, and a couple people have messaged me saying that they were going to be there doing some demonstrations, which is cool. And like the tactical field, side, but yeah, so I'm really excited about that. And I know we're doing for the listeners out there, if it's something that you can't attend, obviously because of your location or your credentials in getting into the show, we're going to do a live Instagram live and Facebook live on the Dogtra social media. So we're going to be answering questions and going live, and I'm going to be kind of walking you through our booth a little bit and going over what we're doing and all the shenanigans that we're doing. And so that's going to be an exciting thing. And so Pete, you're going to be there the whole week.
I arrived Sunday night with booth setup.
Okay.
And then I depart early Friday morning, the last day of the show, which is normally the least busy day of the show. But our Monday's booth set up, Tuesday's the opening of the show, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I'll be at the booth pretty much from start to finish, excuse me, each and every day.
Cool. Yeah, I'm excited about it. Okay. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, Pete. Do you have anything else you want to say to the people out there, or do you feel like you've got enough off your chest for today?
Yeah, we could, you and I are very much alike. We could have done this for 2 hours.
And, oh yeah.
You know, I don't even know. I haven't looked at a clock, but we've probably been doing this for close to an hour.
Yep.
And it seems like only 10 minutes, but you know, I'm like you, Tom, I have a passion for dogs. I have the passion for a well-trained dog. I'm a proponent of the remote training collar. I work for a company now that sells a pretty high-end training collar. I've seen the value of this product for years. I'd like to think I kind of know it in and out, and I'm very, very, always very interested in what can be done with it and the new technology. And you'll see some of our new technology we're coming out with at the show as well, Tom. That's always kind of exciting. But you and I could go, we maybe need to do another one of these and we can hash some things over. I think one of the things that if we can get the listeners to chime in, the days of the SHOT Show when we're doing those Facebook Live might be kind of fun. They can ask questions. You and I'll be there, and we've got a guy by the name of Cody Glancy, the Kentucky Cooner, we call him on YouTube.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about him. I was on a conference call with Steve and Lorraine yesterday, and they were telling me about Cody. What does he do?
Cody's a barber by trade, but he's knows our GPS system in and out. He's a coon hunter, and great guy. I've met him when I was down in Indiana here a couple of years ago, and he and I kind of got connected the same way you and I did on a phone call. And I think he called the company first and said, hey, do you got somebody I can talk to? And they sent him over to talk to Pete out in Minnesota. And he and I got to know each other, developed a friendship. And he does a lot of things for the company, similar to you do, but more so in the coon hunting, the GPS sector. You'll love him. He's a great guy, good guy to BS with. We're going to have the three of us that have a lot of fun out there. And so I'm really looking forward to that. But he'll be there to... we'll have him on the Facebook Live to talk to the coon hunters and the people that want to know about our GPS product, because he really knows it in and out. And so that's why we got him there. And then you and I guess, are just there for eye candy, just for looks. So
anyway,
it'll be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too, Pete. And what I'm going to do is on my Instagram, I'm gonna announce all the times that we're going to go live, and I want to chat with everybody on Facebook and on Instagram. That'll be a lot of fun, and people can get an inside look of SHOT Show and what we're up to. And I think we'll do this again, Pete, and I appreciate your time, and we will see you in a couple weeks.
Very good. Sounds good. Stay warm.
All right, man. We'll talk to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, guys, that's the wrap-up for Pete and Dogcha. Thank you, Pete, for coming on. Very insightful. I learned a lot. I hope that you guys as listeners got some insight and learned some new things about e-collar history and Dogcha and its brand. And I really enjoyed it, and I look forward to SHOT Show here in a couple weeks. And again, if you guys don't follow me on Instagram, you can, at Tom Davis. I'm going to be announcing. We're going to go live, and I'm going to answer as many questions as I possibly can about you and your dog and any remote collar training. And if you guys are going to be at SHOT Show, we can see you there, and I appreciate y'all. Peace.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.